Good afternoon, and I'll call the April 7th meeting of the Senate Rules Committee to order. And we will, I'm sure, have a quorum shortly, but we're going to start by opening a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 38. And Erin?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. SJR 38 proposes amendment to the Oregon Constitution to allow legislative assembly or people through initiative process to enact laws limiting or prohibiting contributions or expenditures made in connection with campaigns for nomination or election to public office. Refers proposed amendment to people at the next regular general election. You have two pieces of testimony we received this morning from Common Cause Oregon and League of Women Voters.
Thank you, Erin. And I see Senator Devlin is here to tell us about this bill. So welcome back to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to present this bill to you, and I appreciate the time and consideration you're giving it. I think that what you might expect, the testimony I would give and the testimony I give may be slightly different. I've actually been in this building for about 15 years. My elections number in the dozens, to be quite honest. I probably have raised more money than most of the people in the legislature for campaigns. But since the beginning of my tenure in the legislature and before that, I saw that there were considerable issues in this state over campaign finance. I can tell you when I began in this process, not the first time I was elected, but the second time, the average cost for a contested House race was probably a seriously contested one, was in the $250,000 range. Obviously, Senate races were, the most contested were a little bit higher than that. Bring that to current dollars, we now have House races that sometimes hit the $500,000-$600,000 range, even $700,000. And of course, we have the noticeable exceptions that have exceeded $1 million. We all know in the Senate, in very close contested races, we're probably in the $500,000-$800,000 range, and we probably have the same level of inflation, the same amount of issues are presented as they've been presented in the past. We will probably be over $1 million per candidate in a contested Senate race. This obviously has significant implications, policy implications. I used to be, obviously, in your capacity, Madam Chair, as the chair of this committee, and I sat through many of these hearings. But my opinion has actually changed a little bit over time about campaign finance reform. I, like many others in this building, have traditionally just introduced the couple of words changes in the Constitution that opens up the freedom of expression clause so that you can act campaign finance reform. My concern is now, and how I have changed, is my concern is that if the Constitution is ever opened up, whoever is actually in power within this building or within the majority in this building, or whoever gets the first initiative to the ballot, will actually be writing campaign laws that are in their own best interest and not in the broad interest of Oregonians. And that's regardless of who is in control, because that's actually what most of the discussions have been when campaign finance laws are put into place. Now, there is a tendency here to confuse this discussion with the recent Supreme Court case. I think all of us that are in the legislature probably had people coming to us saying, how does this affect campaign finance in Oregon, this recent Supreme Court case that appeared to give personhood to corporations? Well, the reality is for our legislative races, it had no impact whatsoever, none, because we have no limitations, and for all practical purposes, the Supreme Court case, which is now the law of the land, that's what happens when the Supreme Court acts, has no impact here because we actually have no limitations. And now we obviously could not pass limitations that would be in violation of that decision by the Supreme Court. I have indicated that my primary concern here is that people come in and they want to do campaign finance reform and they believe it's urgent. And what I used to tell them is to go see Ted Ruttlinger, because I would tell them, go see Ted Ruttlinger, and usually that would discourage them so much when they realized what they could do and what they could not do, That would usually end the discussion, and as chair of the Rules Committee, I would not have to sit through another discussion of campaign finance reform. But I, like I said, I am somewhat concerned that if we do actually get a constitutional amendment proposed, and it's just as limited as some of them that I've seen, that what we will have is basically whoever is in control of this legislature or whoever gets the first initiative on the ballot will actually be writing campaign finance reform in their own interest. I think many of us know that Oregon is kind of unique. We are only one of four states without any type of campaign finance limitation. And I think what we need to realize is that we've had semi-successful and successful attempts at changing the Constitution in this state in the past. We all remember Measure 6 and Measure 9 that were passed in 1994 and were in effect for the 1996 elections. I went through one of those elections, a fairly highly contested election. I can tell you that the most complex campaign finance rules anybody has ever seen in their lifetime. When you have to distinguish between somebody giving you a limit of $100 or whether they've previously given you cookies at an event you went to as part of a campaign, they have to take that off the $100. And I mean, when people that actually don't understand campaigns or don't understand what it costs to run campaigns, try to write campaign finance reform, they write some really weird provisions into law. Obviously, our Supreme Court threw out both of those ultimately because they ultimately violated probably both the Freedom of Expression Clause in the Oregon Constitution and the Freedom of Speech Clause in the U.S. Constitution. Of course, now we know also that recently in 2006, Measure 46 and 47 were put on the ballot. The constitutional amendment failed. The statutory initiative passed, but it is actually on hold because our Constitution would not permit it to go into effect. At least that's the current opinion. This measure before you does not enact campaign finance reform. It simply makes it possible. Now, there are constitutional scholars that may speak here today that will tell you, because there's disagreement amongst constitutional scholars, about whether this achieves its underlying purpose or not. But what this basically does is integrates the change in the Freedom of Expression Clause with the Equal Protection Clause in Section 20 and makes it a strict test, which is normally referred to as a Privileges and Immunities Clause. And so the basic issue here would be that under this clause, I think the basic way that this would be understood is that campaign finance reform could only be enacted. It could not favor any particular group. It cannot favor any particular individual or group of individuals or any particular types of groups. It would have to be relatively even-handed, and it would have to be actually not put in place in such a way that it would be to the benefit of one party or the other. It's basically sort of a strict test under that clause of the Constitution. And I think actually by doing that, there would be a little bit better chance that what was being enacted would actually be a fairer form of campaign finance reform than we would get if we simply changed the Oregon Constitution simply to permit under the Freedom of Expression Clause campaign finance reform. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. Any questions for the good senator?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
Thank you for bringing us this, Senator Devlin. This is one of those things where everybody knows what we have is problematical in any number of ways, and yet when you try to fix it, you end up in a hole that you never even anticipated. I actually, in my first campaign, I ran under that measure that you under the campaign finance measure that you referred to, $100 maximum contributions. And actually, personally, I liked it. I sent out fundraising letters that said, for $100, you could be my largest contributor. And I was able to raise, I didn't get quite to the $32,000, I believe, limit in a primary, but I was able to raise enough to make a credible campaign, and it was a very healthy feeling that there were no huge contributions there. But other races in that cycle, the candidates complied with the law, and then they had these huge outside campaigns. And so what it amounted to is interest groups for and against a certain candidate put huge amounts of money into the campaign. They ran the campaign that they wanted, so the voter could not tell anything about the candidate from the campaign itself, because the campaigns were being run by outside interests as independent campaigns, and the candidate themselves, because they didn't have enough money to get their voice out, was basically unheard. I thought that was extremely unhealthy for a democracy, because I think voters should be able to tell from a campaign what the candidate is like. This measure, you know, how do you see us getting past that problem?
Well, I will tell you, if I brought Mr. Ruttlinger in here or our current counsel to this committee, they would tell you that it is extremely difficult of what you can do, even if you modify the Constitution, to limit independent expenditures. You know, you can just go down the list of issues that you would have. Could you modify independent expenditures? Could you limit an individual that could self-finance to any particular limit, since it was their own resources? There's a whole question about if you can limit expenditures versus limiting contributions. There are so many issues in this. If I might comment, Madam Chair, I actually went through that same campaign cycle that Senator Burdick had indicated. I was in one of the most highly contested races, actually, in that campaign cycle. I had more than 1,000 individual contributors and raised over $51,000 in that campaign cycle, and so did my opponent, actually. But in both cases, I think there was at least $100,000 spent on both sides. There were independent expenditures that neither one of us had any control over, and that the reality is that for most of the candidates that were out there, they could barely raise the money to send a single mailing, because if you were not in a significantly contested race, you really didn't have the pull to basically raise the money that you would need to raise to have a basic campaign. That is why I think sometimes when people come before the legislature and they want to do campaign finance reform, why I think there are so many things out there that people have to think about, not only all the constitutional issues around this, but also the issues of how you would construct something that would be fair and what is a reasonable cost. There are still people out there that believe that you should be able to run a Senate campaign for $20,000 and a House campaign for $10,000. In this modern-day media markets and everything else that you have, and modern-day postal rates and everything else, it is very difficult. I will agree with you, however, that system, in the way it was constructed, forced people to go out and talk to more people that they normally have to talk to in a campaign, and it actually built me up some of probably the best lists I think any legislator has ever developed, actually, because of having to go out and talk to so many people.
Madam Chair, if
yes,
I could follow up. Senator Devlin, in the early 70s, we had a campaign law called the Single Treasurer Law, which was thrown out, I think, in 1974 or 1975 as being unconstitutional under the freedom of expression constitutional provisions. This single treasurer provision required that all expenditures for anybody's campaign be run through that campaign, basically, that it basically prohibited independent expenditures. Do you see that as something, a direction that we could go under your provision?
I think you could go that direction under this provision. I think the reality is, though, if anyone seriously wanted to approach campaign finance reform, they shouldn't do it by introducing a single bill, whether it's a single constitutional amendment in a session, that they would need to do an immense amount of work to make sure that they had literally dotted all their I's and crossed all their T's, and they had gained at least the neutrality of some of the people that are behind me that want to speak, actually. If not support. I was bringing this forward because I will tell you I do have a basic concern that sooner or later somebody's going to pass a constitutional amendment. They think that they're going to have resolved the issue, and the issue is only going to begin. Because until you put some safeguards in this, until you put some sideboards on it, I do believe whoever gets the first initiative on the ballot or whoever is in control in the legislature, presuming they can get by a governor's veto, is going to actually write campaign finance reform in their own interests.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And Senator Devlin, you mentioned the two measures that voters had a chance to look at and want the statutory one passed and the constitutional amendment failed. And I apologize if this isn't something that you've had a chance to explore with legislative counsel, but do you know if a measure like this, a different constitutional amendment, were to be put in front of voters and they voted in favor of it, what effect that would have on the measure 47, which seems to be in kind of a limbo status in the courts right
well,
now?
Well, I think I am not a constitutional scholar, nor am I an attorney. And
you don't play one
woman
on television.
The young
either.
Woman that is to my right, to your left, who actually is a practicing attorney and my LA legislative assistant, will admit she is not a constitutional scholar either. And constitutional scholars regularly disagree on what the interpretation of the Constitution would be. I would think it would have to meet a test under this, and I think any future reform would have to meet a test, how the courts would decide whether or not this provision would be taken as strictly as we would hope it would be taken. It would be hard to tell until you actually had a decision being made. Madam Chair, if I might comment about one other thing, because I appreciate the time that the committee has given me. I was asked by an associate of one of the people that will come up and testify, didn't I agree that because we have such an open process that people are more likely to give directly to the candidate and not to actually pass money through other areas, or that it's much easier to follow campaign contributions. And as a person that has looked at this over the years, I can tell you, to be quite honest, that Bugsy Siegel or any other people from history would probably delight at how well we launder money through various different quarters in our current system and how many different paths it can take before it gets it to its ultimate intended party.
Yes, Senator Farioli.
Madam Chairman, I too ran during the era of campaign limitations, and like Senator Burdick, I didn't have any problem raising the $30,000 limit. And she just remembers that it was 32, it was 30, and 60. It was pretty easy to remember because it was 30 and 60. And there were huge independent expenditures. You know, I thought it odd that my opponent, who had to cover the same 17,000 square miles that I did, only raised $10,000 for the general. You know, there was some speculation that perhaps there was something else going on there, but it was only speculation. Eventually, there were independent expenditures totaling a couple hundred thousand dollars in that race. And, you know, you'd open a newspaper and see a full-page ad, you know, by one or the other of the campaigns. And I'm perfectly willing to concede that neither of the candidates knew when they were going to be placed or what they were going to contain or who even was doing independent expenditures until you opened the newspaper or saw the billboard or heard the radio ad. The takeaway from there, in addition to the Supreme Court ruling about the unconstitutionality of limitations on free speech, was that we're much better served attacking the problem that the good senator has brought to our attention, and that is if there's an obscure trail between the actual donor and the actual recipient, we ought to do more about public disclosure. It ought to be more transparent and less easy to keep from disclosure. That comports with Oregon's very strong tradition of free speech and its very strong tradition of open government. So I would just argue that rather than limiting the scope of the Constitution and risking a trip to the federal courts for First Amendment abridgment, probably the thing that we could do more profitably is spend more time making sure that transparency and full disclosure is more real and there are more penalties for violations. I think that would get us to a place where Oregonians could finally be able to thread the needle and understand who are the donors and who are the recipients.
And Senator Ferriola, I didn't hear a question, but Senator Devlin, would you like to
comment? Well, Madam Chair, I will just, if there are no more questions, I will just close and thank you for this, and I can tell you that I actually agree with Senator Ferrioli in terms of disclosure, and I think that there are issues there. But I will tell you that I just thought it would be a good thing to bring before this committee a campaign finance measure. I have sat through many discussions on them. I've sent many people down to legislative council to have their dreams torn away from them when they were told what all the limitations would be potentially of any reforms that they would want to enact. So I just thought I should make life fair to you and the other committee members now being on the other side and have you sit through a campaign finance discussion.
Yes, Senator Ferrioli.
That's the equivalency, I think, of the Shakespearean tradition of having the murder occur off stage.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli. Thank you, Senator
Thank you.
Devlin. And we have one person signed up to testify, and that's David Fidenke, if you'd like to come forward.
Thank you,
Madam
Chair. Good afternoon,
and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, and thank you, members of the committee. It's my first chance to testify before my returning state senator, Senator Beyer. I'm a resident of East Eugene, and it's a delight to see you back in the chair, Senator.
Thank you.
And I'm here with a number of ACLU members in the building today for our lobby day. And one of the major topics are the dangers of amending the Oregon Bill of Rights, and in particular the Oregon Free Expression Protection, which would be the effect of Senate Joint Resolution 38 if it were to be placed on the ballot and approved by the voters. The handout I have asked staff to give to you is the results from the constitutional amendment election in 2006 that, Madam Chair, you were referencing earlier. And I wanted to point out that not only did the statute be approved by the voters and the constitutional amendment was defeated, but it was defeated in every county in the state of Oregon. And it was defeated because it was pointed out to voters that that constitutional amendment, which is very similar to this one, in its attempt to grant permission to the legislature and the people to impose restrictions and prohibitions on campaign contributions and expenditures, the voters understood that that would have the effect of undermining the Oregon Free Expression Clause and therefore defeated it. So I think several of you have highlighted the biggest problem with amending the Oregon Constitution related to this issue, which is that when most people think about election campaign finance problems, they think about two things. Number one, they think about the federal system, which is very different from the system that applies to state and local races here in Oregon. And that federal system with contribution limits is what spawned the independent expenditure problems that are now rampant in the federal system. So there have been two major impacts from the U.S. Supreme Court's decision back in 1975, whenever it was, on Buckley versus Valeo, which is that the court said, number one, you can limit direct contributions to candidates, but you cannot limit independent expenditures that have no connection to the candidates, and you cannot limit the expenditures of candidates who give to themselves, that is, candidates who are independently wealthy and can spend unlimited amounts of their own money in their campaigns. The result of that in the federal system has been widespread independent expenditure campaigns that are not controlled by the candidates, and a large number of independently wealthy candidates. We have not seen either of those things in Oregon, with the exception of that one cycle back in the 1990s. And that is a good thing. We should not be opening the door to the same problems that the federal system has had for so many years. There are problems, and the second issue that I think most people think about is the expense of campaigns, and that is a huge problem. It is a deterrent to people coming forward and running for public office who would make great elected officials. Notwithstanding that problem, all of you are here today. And all of you have shown great dedication to this state and to the public affairs of our state. And I think you know as well as anyone the pluses and the minuses of our current campaign finance system. This measure, as well intentioned as it is by Senator Devlin, we don't think is going to move this issue forward. ACLU supports public financing of election campaigns to guarantee that all candidates have a fundamental floor of financing to be able to get their message out. That would encourage more candidates rather than fewer, and we think would be good for the political system. But in the meantime, we're not happy with the status quo, but we're happier with the status quo than we would be with undermining the Oregon Free Expression provision. And for that reason, we are opposed to SJR 38. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And of course, this proposal doesn't actually seem to amend Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution. It takes a somewhat different approach, but I think you said earlier that you think it has the same effect as
it clearly would have that effect. It doesn't matter where you put it in the Constitution, Madam Chair. The barrier to contribution and expenditure limitations and expenditures is the Oregon Free Expression Clause. If you think about it, and the Oregon Supreme Court has held as much, why is it that we make contributions to candidates? We make contributions because we support the views of a particular candidate. So a contribution of money is an expression of support for a candidate. And that is what the Oregon Supreme Court has said. It's also what the U.S. Supreme Court has said. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld contribution limits under the First Amendment on the theory that contributions over a certain amount might give the impression of undue influence. In Oregon, impressions are not good enough. We can prohibit and have prohibited bribery of candidates and public officials, and we cannot prohibit under our laws, as long as the organ free expression provision is in place, we cannot prohibit someone from communicating their support of a candidate by making a contribution to that candidate, and nor should we try.
Questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
I just wanted to ask what your opinion or perception, whether the single treasurer approach might be something that would be worth exploring.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, I think the problem with trying to force contributions to candidates as opposed to our current system, which encourages that, is that under the federal constitution, you cannot prohibit someone from speaking independently if they choose to do so. And so there isn't any change we could make to the Oregon constitution that would change that problem with trying to prohibit independent expenditures. They can't be prohibited under the First Amendment. So there's nothing you could do to the Oregon Constitution that would allow that to happen.
That's useful to know, Madam Chair. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator Burdick.
I should, Madam Chair, just say one other thing, which Senator Devlin mentioned, that he was neither a constitutional scholar nor an attorney, and neither am I. Thank you.
Thank you. I did, before you go, want to ask you one more thing. So you mentioned going back to Buckley and that decision, but more recently, and it seems like what we hear a lot about these days is the Citizens United decision, which seems to have then sparked challenges to a lot of campaign finance laws around the country, or at least sort of speculation about whether states that seem to have settled law are going to then face challenges. So do you think the implications of the more recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions are that there's just no point in anybody even thinking about this anymore, or what does that mean?
Well, Madam Chair, I think it's always good to think about issues and problems and try to find creative ways to solve them. But I agree with the comment that was made earlier that the Citizens United decision really didn't have any impact with regard to state and local political campaigns in Oregon. It certainly has with regard to federal races. You know, where the U.S. Supreme Court is going is anybody's guess. There is a case before the court this term related to the public financing system that is in place in Arizona, and similar systems are in place in other states. The court has been very protective of expression by corporations. The U.S. Supreme Court has. And in general, the court has been fairly protective of free expression in general. Our courts have been very clear in terms of their interpretation of Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Bill of Rights. And we believe that is a good thing, not a bad thing, and that we shouldn't make the state of Oregon be subject to the prevailing winds on the U.S. Supreme Court, which would be the case if we were to undermine the Oregon Free Expression Clause.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. And we don't have anyone else signed up to testify on SJR 38. Is there anyone who is here who wants to testify? Members, if you weren't here at the beginning of the hearing, there are a couple of pieces of written testimony which you either got on your computer, I think we had them ahead of time, or they're in front of you if you didn't, one from the League of Women Voters and the other from Common Cause. So look at those at your leisure.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Farrelly.
Would there be any benefit? I think there would be some benefit, at least, to reading Article 1, Section 8, so the people listening to the live stream might understand what it is that we're thinking about referring the measure on, because those would be the things affected.
You mean actually reading the Constitution aloud right now into
just
the record?
Just as if we were going to follow it.
I can't answer whether there'd be benefit. I suppose if people are listening to us and don't have access to a computer, we could do that, or we could make it available, I think, on electronically as we're doing with everything else about our hearing.
Madam Chair, I think that would be a good alternative.
Why don't we do that then? Great. Okay, we will. Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that the Constitution is available currently on the legislative work site. Excuse me, legislative website under bills and laws.
Thank you for pointing that out. So if anybody is listening to us and has access to a computer, they can check the legislative website, and we also will post that specific section on our committee's portion of the website. Okay, I don't see anyone else to testify, so I'll close the public hearing on SJR 38. And next, we have two work sessions, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 440. And Erin, tell us where we are with...
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 440 was originally heard in a public hearing on March 3rd. 440 is a measure that changes boards and commissions and permits meeting by phone or other electronic means, clarifies some statute per diem practice for 15 boards and commissions that legislators or elected officials serve on. There is a spreadsheet in your packet of the affected boards and how the measure changes them. And then it clarifies that if elected officials appointed to or serve on a board or commission or task force that is entitled to per diem, they may collect the per diem and reimbursement only if they attend in person. If they choose to participate via phone or electronic means, they are not entitled to reimbursement. The measure repeals of three silent boards and adds pharmacy tech to board of pharmacy. There is a fiscal statement on the original measure relative to the cost of the addition of the Board of Pharmacy member. There is a -1 amendment before you. The -1 amendment deletes two task force that sunsetted since the original drafting of the bill, the Cost Efficiency Task Force and the MPO Task Force, and it also removes the pharmacy tech from the measure. The member who originally sponsored the pharmacy tech addition in 2009 has a standalone bill to correct that omission from 2009. There is a fiscal on the -1 amendment, but I will highlight the second sentence of the first paragraph. The changes to the board and commission per diem and electronic means has minimal or no fiscal impact, and deletion of the boards has no fiscal impact because there is no money appropriated to them. There's also a -3 amendment, which establishes requirement that DCBS licensing boards, state plumbing board, electronic and elevator board, and board of rules, and let me grab... and establishes requirement that non-licensing boards meet at least twice a year, which is the Building Code Structures Board, Residential and Manufactured Structures Board, Mechanical Board, and Construction Industry Energy Board, and it permits the boards to meet at other times and places specified by the call of the majority of the members after consultation with the director. There is a fiscal on the -3 amendment. I will point out that it is not relative to the changes related to DCBS, but it, again, it's relative to the fact that they do not omit the pharmacy tech board in their amendment because that is already done in the -1 amendment. Therefore, the net effect of both proposed changes in the -1 and the -3 when combined into a single amendment would be, as indicated to me, a minimal fiscal effect. So there would be no fiscal statement because we are removing the piece of the measure that creates the fiscal, which is the pharmacy tech. So those are what are before you today. We do have both Andrea Fogg from DCBS and Ryan Mann from the Senate President's Office if there are any questions about the measure or the amendment.
Could you repeat all that, please?
Yeah.
Just play the tape back.
Okay, thank you, Erin. Yes, Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, just a curiosity question. The portion regarding members of the legislature, has anybody checked to see if this is consistent with the House and Senate rules? I think they supersede the statutes with regards to what members do.
It is my understanding that where it was not specified in statute about whether or not a per diem is available, that it was decisions were made by the Senate President and the Speaker as to whether or not the per diem was provided. And so the boards that are silent that now are no longer silent are based on decisions relative to the Speaker and the President.
The current ones.
The current, yes.
OK, Okay. So, and Aaron, just to clarify then, although we haven't adopted either of these amendments into the bill yet, the fiscal implications of the bill did come from the pharmacy technician issue, which has now been, would be removed if we adopted the dash ones.
Yes, that is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. So we do have, I know, a representative of Department of Consumer and Business Services in the audience. If there are any questions about the DCBS licensing and non-licensing boards, and we are in a work session.
Are you looking at me, Madam Chair, to move a dash three amendment? If so,
or the
so
dash
moved.
One amendment, or
I said the dash three.
You'd like to move the dash three amendments? Okay.
No,
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, the dash one and the dash three are two different amendments, so we would need to remove them both if, in fact, we...
Right, they haven't, right. Dash threes didn't incorporate the
dash
one, so,
Then I still move the dash threes.
Okay. Senator Atkinson has moved the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 440. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Is there any objection to the dash three amendment? Seeing none, it's so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment.
And Senator Atkinson moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 440. Is there any discussion on that amendment? Is there any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, it's so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 440 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 440 as amended by the dash one and dash three amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, Mike, why don't you call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Beyer?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Excused.
Vice Chair Farioli?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Motion carries. And this is Senator Courtney's bill, so for the moment we'll ask Senator Courtney to carry it on the floor if he wishes to do so. If not, we'll take another look. Okay, thank you, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 440 and open a work session on Senate Bill 676.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 676 was originally heard on March 31st, and the measure directs Oregon Department of Administrative Services and Governor submit continuous improvement level state budget based on performance management and performance management techniques. The measure does specify contents of budget and allows Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Emergency Board, and Legislative Fiscal Office to review performance management and performance management processes for services contracted by state and local officials and school districts, and directs Governor and Chief Justice to report to Legislative Assembly on plan to implement continuous improvement strategies. There is an emergency clause and is effective upon passage. It does have a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. There is a fiscal statement in front of you on Senate Bill 676.
Thank you, Erin. And members, you'll remember that we heard this bill, I believe, just last week at our hearing, that it results from the recommendations of a work group or task force that took a look at the budget process and thought that this would be perhaps a fruitful approach. It was called the Committee on Performance Excellence that came forward with this recommendation. It has to go to Ways and Means. I think we heard some testimony from senators both on and not on Ways and Means that they thought this would be worth exploring in a session where we're looking very hard at the way we budget. And so I think the idea would be to just let this go forward, the Ways and Means Committee, so that they could consider it and work on it some more.
With the recommendation?
Yes, with the recommendation would be great. Senator Beyer, did you have a motion?
I do. I would move Senate Bill 676 to Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 676 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, is there any objection to that motion? Seeing none, motion is carried, and the bill will move to the Ways and Means Committee. And Senator Burdick, we are in a work session on Senate Bill 676, which was the budgeting bill that we heard last week. So we've just adopted a motion to send it to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Would you like to be?
Yes, I would like to be counter, Madam
Chair. Okay, and how do you vote?
I vote yes.
Great. So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 676. And we also moved another bill in your absence, Senator Burdick, and that was Senate Bill 440, which went to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Can we reopen, just reopen the work session? So I'll reopen the work session on Senate Bill 440 for the purpose of allowing Senator Burdick to cast her vote.
Thank you for your courtesy, Madam Chair. Burdick votes aye.
Okay, Senator Burdick has voted aye on Senate Bill 440, and that moved to the floor. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 440. Members, we do have a hearing next week, same time, same place. We do have one executive appointment to consider at that time, and that's Michael Jordan, who appeared before us already as a witness, but will be appearing before us for a confirmation recommendation, and we may have other bills to consider next week, too.
So the Director of Continuous Performance Improvement?
I think we could ask him about that. Okay, with nothing further to come before us, we're adjourned.